Good afternoon, everybody. Beautiful Sabbath day for sure. God has a way of providing for certain, right? It's a pleasure to be here with you today. I would like to say this. I think it would be ungracious on my part not to mention the impact yesterday's service had on me personally, and I suspect on all who were there. Of course, what each of us takes from such experiences is deeply personal. It was, to me, a singular event, very humbling. I'll confess, I've never witnessed such an amazing service and come away so fortified to face life and death. So I'll leave it at that. When I was a wee lad, a few moons ago, I shared a bedroom with my younger brother. My bed was on the outside wall, and my brother's was closest to the door. I learned at the age, tender age of 4 or 5, I can't remember exactly how old I was, that my courage tend to diminish with the setting of the sun. I was afraid of the dark and what it contained. The dangers for a four or five-year-old, thank you, sir, thank you, lurked everywhere and in everything. Now, I spent many, many hours hidden under the covers, my imagination running wild, waiting for just the right moment to flee to safety. I don't know if any of you have ever been in that spot, but over 66, and I can remember like yesterday how it was. More times than I can count, I made a run for it. If my mom and dad were alive today, they would vouch for me. At least I think they would. I hope they would. I got quite good at it, actually. The first rule was, no way could you touch the floor and live. Whatever was down there devoured young boys. In truth, I guess on reflection, the adversary is working on me even in those early days. But I had a finely tuned escape protocol. You see, I can picture it now. Not that you can, but let me see if I can paint a picture. Next to the wall, probably 10 feet from the door. All right, so I'd be under those covers for what seemed like hours, maybe it was just minutes. I thrust the covers off onto my brother's bed. He was a sound sleeper, by the way, and I never broke any of his bones, so I assumed that he never got too hurt in this process. I fling open the door, race to my parents' room, and relief, until I was sent back into the den of darkness, of course. Now, again, eventually I got out of it, grew out of it. After all, it's a bit embarrassing to be running into your parents' bedroom when you're 15. So it's a matter of, as you grow, of course, you grow out of those fears and into other ones, perhaps. Fear, a condition shared by virtually all human beings, is what I'd like to touch on today. The subject is broad and deep. I know it reaches to the very core of what we are, aided and abetted by an adversary that majors in fear, as we know. Now, this message was conceived from Micah 4:4. You don't need to turn there. I think if you can just kind of reflect on it, it's probably referred to many times during the coming Feast of Tabernacles. Every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. No one shall make them afraid. And apart from the child leading the lamb and the lion, I can't think of too many scriptures that typify, symbolize that glorious time we call the thousand-year reign of Christ or the millennium. This is not going to be a how-to sermon. I'll leave that to others. It's more of a survey of the way the world is and what it will become and how God is working with you and me, preparing us for that true, brave, new world. Let me ask a question here. Is there anyone here who is fearless. Anybody? Fearless. Without fears of any stripe. I suspected the same. Nobody raised hands, and maybe you are, and you just didn't feel courageous enough to raise your hand. I don't know. But I know this is definitely the case. It's similar to what's stated in 1 John 1:8. If we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we say that we have no fears, the same would probably be accurate as well. No, I don't think there's anybody here who would state unequivocally, I have no fears. So we're all in the same boat in that sense. No mysteries there. So the question is why, and we'll certainly get into that. Now, I believe the only way to describe our world today is fearful. Fearful. There is a palpable unease. You can sense in virtually everyone you meet. As a member of a family-owned business, you get a chance to check the pulse of those who work with you. And I can only say, from my perspective, the angst continues to grow. They see a lot of things. They don't understand any of it, or much of it anyway. And that just creates in them a sense of unease, if you will, and fear, and fear. It's been that way for nearly 6,000 years, as we know. It is a world that groans, as Paul was inspired to write in Romans 8:22. Now, fear, concern or dread about what may or may not happen in the here and now or in the future, drives two primary outcomes. Fear either distances us from God or drives us closer to God. Now, I've got a list of phobias here, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. There are a lot of them, as you can probably guess. Phobias are considered one of the most common mental illnesses in the United States today. They figure 8% of the population suffers from some type of phobia, and phobia is obviously fear on steroids. Phobia is basically, it drives one to almost a catatonic response to whatever fear there is. But I'm just going to read through some of these. The first one, it goes alphabetical. The first one is acluophobia, fear of darkness. I guess I would have qualified in my early days for that. I actually knew a man one time who was no longer living, but until the day he died, he left the light on when he went to bed. He couldn't handle the darkness. And maybe you know somebody like that. It happens. Fear of being alone, autophobia. Here's a good one for Minnesotans. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing this Greek word properly, but I'll give it a shot. Geonophobia, fear of snow. I don't imagine there's too many of those here during the coming months, but who knows. One that's modern in scope, cyberphobia. I think you can probably guess that. Fear of computers. Sometimes I have a dread of computers, especially when it eats your homework or your sermon, right? And you didn't back up properly. Ever been there? I think a lot of us have. Here's a good one. No offense to the younger crowd here today, but ephibophobia, fear of teenagers. Glossophobia, fear of speaking in public. Anybody have a fear of speaking in public? I think there's probably a couple out there. And then aphidiophobia, fear of snakes. I've got a daughter. We have a daughter that basically turns catatonic when she sees one of those little wiggly things going by. So I don't think any of us here have phobias, but nonetheless, I think a lot of us have some fears, right? Some fears. So fear does, like I said, one of two things. It either drives us away from God or drives us closer to our father and elder brother. And as a Christian, or one being called by God, we experience both of these. We'll concentrate mainly, though, not exclusively on number two, but for the most part on number two. I'm convinced we are of those spoken of by Paul in Hebrews 10:39, but we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but those who believe to the saving of the soul. Okay, as you can appreciate, both Hebrew and Greek have a number of words used to describe fear. Hebrew has four primary ones. I'm not going to list them. We're going to focus on the Greek here a little bit for a reason. There are actually two Greek words that stand out. The first is phobos, from which we get the term, phobia, of course. But it means fear or terror. And then the second one is delia, D-E-I-L-I-A, and it denotes fearfulness, actually cowardice or timidity, and that one is never used in a good sense. We see this one, and I'll just touch on it briefly, in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, a memory scripture for a lot of us. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, that's delia, timidity or cowardice, but of power, to change, to become like our father and elder brother, and of love, to truly love as they love, and of a sound mind to grasp reality. As I believe was fully demonstrated in the life of Sarah Jezebel. In John chapter 14, read during the Passover services, Christ said this to his disciples at that critical night. In verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid, timid, or cowardly. And the reason this is so important to us, and the reason I believe it doesn't really pertain to us, is in Revelation chapter 21, verse 8, we see this. But the cowardly, that is, delia, timid, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexual and moral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. But, like I said, that does not apply to us. That's why we're going to focus on the first Greek word, phobos, because it is most germane to our situations as sons and daughters of God. Now, with phobos, fear, we're dealing with a seeming contradiction. On the one hand, it's the same word used to describe two entirely different states of mind for a human being. On the one hand, we're to phobos, fear or reverence God. On the other, we are to fear, phobos, nothing else. Again, the same Greek word is used to describe both conditions or states of mind. And this is a tough challenge for humans. It really is. It really is. As we know, every day we fight fears. I don't care who you are. We all have our own secret, private moments where we wonder, am I going to make it through the day? Vine's Dictionary of New Testament Words does a very good job in framing the understanding for providing two definitions or uses for phobos. The first one is a natural or carnal fear. And it first had meaning of flight, that which is caused by being scared, fear, or subject to terror. This is quite a natural human reaction in the face of danger, perceived or real. I would imagine there were a lot of people down in the Houston area, along the Gulf, who had good reason to fear phobos, or if it didn't touch them, up until the very time they knew they were safe, they were still apprehensive and fearful. I was just listening to the news on the way up. A particular town in that area, and I spent a lot of time in Houston, and to be honest with you, I've seen the before and after shots, and I couldn't even recognize the downtown area. It was like one huge lake, and I've been there many, many times. But one particular city very close to Houston thought they had been spared, okay? But things changed when a dike gave way or something happened, and now they're faced with flooding in the aftermath of that. So a horrific, really historic tragedy. And a lot of people, they figure, 100,000 displaced. Those people, what they're going through, what they'll come back to, I think we can all imagine, because we have homes, we have places to go to. There's a lot of fear in that area. And it's amazing how quickly life can change, as we know. Now, we see this first definition of fear introduced very early in man's experience. In Genesis chapter 3, verses 7 through 11, familiar ground to us. Genesis chapter 3, says this: "Then the eyes of both of them," that is Adam and Eve, "were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden." So they basically had fled from their Creator, as we know. And we've heard sermons on this section many times, so I'm not going to belabor it. I'm just going to point out one thing here that we're well aware of, and that is with sin entered fear. The definition of fear, as man experiences it every day and has for nearly 6,000 years. In verse 9, "Then the Lord God called to Adam and said to him, 'Where are you?'" Of course, God knew, but the question. "And Adam said to him, 'So I heard your voice in the garden,'" that is, Adam said, "'I heard your voice, God, in the garden, and I was afraid.'" I was afraid. This is Hebrew. The word here in Hebrew is yare, Y-A-R-E. It's fear, reverence, equivalent to the Greek phobos. But in this sense, they were just afraid. They fled, whom they considered at this particular time God to be an adversary for whatever reason. And very sad. It goes on to say, "Because I was naked and I hid myself." And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat?" So again, with sin entered fear. So instead of fearing God, reverencing him as their creator, Adam and Eve gave in to the natural fear that comes with disobeying God. And as I said before, it's ever been the case with man. The second definition or use of phobos is, as Vine describes it, this way. It is reverential fear of God as a controlling motive or one's life in matters spiritual, particularly. It's not a mere fear of his power and righteous retribution, but a wholesome dread of displeasing him. When we're called into God's family, like most children, all children, particularly early on, they want to please their parents. And in this case, it hurts us when we know we've done wrong. And we're sometimes a little afraid to face Dad, to be honest with you, to go to him on our knees and ask for forgiveness. We think he'll forget, he'll put it aside, but he doesn't let us get away with too much. In fact, he doesn't let us get away with anything that's going to hurt us long term. Now, he may dwell and bear with us a long time before we come to the realization that, hey, you gotta face facts there and face Dad. But nonetheless, this is the type of fear that is healthy. This is the type of fear that draws us to our father and elder brother. It refers to the disposition and attitude of one whose circumstances are guided by trust in God through the indwelling Spirit of God. So there's bad fear and there's good fear, all encapsulated in the one Greek word, phobos. So again, we have at what first blush looks like a contradiction. But part of that answer to that contradiction lies in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, if you'll turn there. Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Where Christ, and we don't know exactly what led up to this, it's contextual, of course, but Christ tells those who would listen, "Do not fear. Do not fear," or phobos, "those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear," phobos, "him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." And so, what he was saying is perspective here. Perspective. Make a wise choice. There's dumb fear, and then there's smart fear. Same word, but different reactions by all human beings, but particularly those of us who know how we should respond. And so we have a choice to make virtually every day. I'd like us to turn to Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8. We're going to look at some examples of spiritual whiplash, if I can use that. There are four miracles here that are discussed in very quick succession, and they represent four examples of the two uses of the two definitions of phobos, as we'll see here. Now, in the preceding chapter leading up to this section, the apostles were exposed to a number of miracles. I'm giving you a little background here, and not a few other what I would call teachable moments, but they were about to be tested again. And again, these four miracles in quick succession hold many lessons for us, but they also contrast the two types of fears. So again, Luke chapter 8, and there are parallel accounts in Mark 4 and Matthew 8. Okay, if you want to put those in your notes and look at them. In fact, for this first miracle, we are going to go to Mark chapter 4. If you'll turn there with me, we'll come back to Luke 8. But Mark chapter 4, I believe, probably gives us a little more information on this particular subject of phobos. Good fear, bad fear. Okay, Mark chapter 4, beginning in verse 41. There is no 41. 35, excuse me. Mark chapter 4, beginning in verse 35. On the same day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now, when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. So it wasn't just one boat. There were a number accompanying Christ and the apostles at this particular time. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Well, here is Christ, the creator of all the universe, whom they've been walking with for a long time. They had just seen many, many miracles he had performed, and they were afraid. I think most of us would be in that same boat, right? If it was about to be capsized or sunk, I think we'd all naturally have a rapid concern. But in verse 39, when he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace and be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And again, we go back to the context before these four miracles. And he had raised the dead, he had healed many of diseases, and performed many other miracles, cast out demons. But at that particular moment in time, the apostles, like a lot of us would, forgot about all those, and it was our immediate survival, physical survival, that was of utmost importance. And we can understand that as human beings. But Christ expected more. He did expect more at this particular time. And they didn't even have the Spirit in them. The Spirit was working with them. So they do have an expectation for us, which is a good one. That is a healthy one. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And then, notice the reaction, "And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, 'Who can this be, that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" So they, in one sense, in one split second, they go from phobos, the bad fear, worrying about saving their lives and skin, to one of reverencing God, fearing God, the way it should be, the way it should be. Now, you may ask yourself, would God have allowed the boat to sink? Don't know. I suspect not. Christ, of course, could walk on water and would demonstrate that. But nonetheless, the others in the boat, the apostles, weren't so sure that they could do the same. So they were concerned, and naturally so, about losing their lives. So we have a contrast there in a very short period of time between a craven fear, a carnal fear, a natural fear, to one where God reveals himself in an astounding way. And those humans feared him reverentially, the way he should be. Okay, let's move back to Luke chapter 8, and continue on with the second miracle here. Luke chapter 8. So they had just been through this rather traumatic experience, just stepped back on land, and guess what? Test number two, coming right at them. Luke chapter 8, beginning in verse 26. And they sailed to the country of the Gadarenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when he had stepped out on the land, there met him a certain man from the city who had demons for a long time, and he wore no clothes, nor did he live in a house, but in a tomb. So put yourself in the apostles' place. Put yourself in their place. They had just nearly, at least in their minds, lost their lives to a drowning, right? Okay? Christ had saved them. They step out on land, and what do they see? They see a madman coming to them, toward them. We don't know what this madman was doing, but he had no clothes, probably remnants of chains, and screaming, no doubt. Okay? So, all of a sudden, what would your reaction be? I've just gone from barely avoiding drowning to having some madman come right at me, and it would be a little disconcerting, to say the least. Let's skip down. Let's go. Verse 28. And when he saw Jesus, he cried out, fell down before him, and with a loud voice said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." Now, this second miracle is interesting from a number of different points of view. It is one of the longest discussed, and it has parallels in Mark and in Matthew as well. It is probably as long and detailed a miracle or series of events through that miracle other than the man born blind that Christ healed. That was probably even more involved in John. But other than that, you can't point to too many miracles in the Gospels that are explored in more detail than this particular one. So let's continue down here. For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had often seized him, and he was kept under guard, bound with chains and shackles, and he broke the bonds and was driven by the demon into the wilderness. And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," because many demons had entered him. Now, I forget my history. I don't know how many soldiers there are in a legion, but it's a lot. It is a lot. And whether this name typified how many were in this man, we don't know. All we know is this guy had superhuman strength. That's what we know. So he was intimidating. It would be like the Hulk or somebody like that coming at you, and he had with a scowl on his face. It was no doubt a little bit intimidating. But if you look at this particular miracle, there was fear on every side. You had the apostles who had just escaped with their lives, at least in their minds. You had this gentleman who no doubt was fearful all his life and looking for a way of escape. No doubt, not understanding what he was going through. You had the caregivers of the pigs, okay, who got a start when Christ allowed the demons to go into the pigs and race down the hill. Further on, you've got the townspeople, and you've got people in the whole region coming to Christ and basically expressing fear. So everyone around this particular miracle was demonstrating phobos, except, of course, for Jesus. Skipping down to verse 34, when those who fed them saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. And they went out to see what had happened and came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had departed, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. So they were afraid of this guy when he was basically ransacking their community, terrifying kids and women and adult men alike. But when they found him in a sound mind, they were afraid as well. And this wasn't a reverential fear. This was terror because they didn't understand. In verse 36, they also had seen it told them by what means he had been demon-possessed was healed. Then the whole multitude of the surrounding region of the Gadarenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear, and he got into the boat and returned. Now, that wasn't the end of the story. This is a particularly unusual miracle because it was performed on a Gentile, and that didn't happen very often. It wasn't without precedent. There are a number of other examples, of course. The Greek woman comes to mind, and, of course, there were several others. But this was unusual from the standpoint of how this individual reacted. Remember, everybody else, other than Christ, was besieged by a bad form of fear, phobos. But this gentleman got the message. In verse 38, now the man from whom the demons had departed begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you. And he went his way and proclaimed throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. So here was an individual, and we don't know what happened to this gentleman. We can speculate when the church was formed. Was he a part of it? We don't know. But obviously, his fear, phobos, terror, carnal fear, turned to reverential, very quickly. Third miracle. Same chapter. We skip down to verse 40. And the third miracle is actually tucked into the fourth one here. So let's go down to verse 40 and just begin reading. So it was when Jesus returned and the multitude welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was the ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. But as he went, the multitude thronged him. So Christ was asked to come and perform another miracle, but in between here is tucked this third miracle. In verse 43, now a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years who had spent all her livelihood on physicians and could not be healed by any. So imagine an affliction lasting 12 years, and some of you probably have experienced that. Day in and day out, never knowing if I'm ever going to feel better, always fearing the worst. Of course, that wears on you. So she was at the end of her rope, and I think most of us could put ourselves in her place. This was an act of desperation. Was it a faith? Yes. But, you know, it was also an act of desperation. She was afraid to touch Christ and probably afraid not to touch Christ. Now, a woman, again, she came from behind and touched the border of his garments. And immediately her flow of blood stopped. And Jesus said, who touched me? And when all denied it, in verse 45, Peter and those with him said, Master, the multitudes throng and press you, and you say, who touched me? But Jesus said, somebody touched me, for I perceive power going out from me. Now when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling. And falling down before him, she declared to him in the presence of all the people the reason she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. So, again, this was a mixed bag here. As you can put yourself in her mind, her state of mind, she knew what she had done. She touched Christ. It was an act of faith. She was healed immediately. But she didn't know how he or the crowd necessarily would react. Okay? So she comes trembling, not knowing how Christ was going to treat her, although she probably could have figured that out, but she was in a state of mind of a big twist in between, a little bit terrified of what just happened after 12 years, but also elated, exalted, because, I'm whole again. I'm healthy for the first time in 12 years. Verse 48, and he said to her, daughter, be of good cheer. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace. So again, we've got two types of phobos working there at one time. And fortunately, the reverential one won out. Okay, then miracle four, we've already touched on a little bit. Parents came to Christ. It is the worst possible nightmare, a child who is on the deathbed, and they're looking for a blessing, a miracle, obviously. So let's pick it up in verse 49. when he was still speaking. So again, keep in mind, these miracles were bang, 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 bang for the apostles. And you have to keep in mind what the apostles were going through here in terms of how they were observing how Christ worked, trying to keep the crowd away from him maybe a little bit, but also in obviously in amazement. But sometimes you're so close to these situations that you fail to realize, you know, what's going on, right? They'd seen probably hundreds of miracles, and yet it wasn't always registering the way our father and elder brother want that to register in our minds as his children. Because we see miracles every day in our lives and the lives of others, and we don't always recognize them for what they are. But on reflection, a lot of times we can think back and say, yes, yes, that was truly a great blessing, a miracle. Someone came from the ruler of the synagogue in verse 49's house, saying to him, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher." But when Jesus heard it, he answered and said, "Do not be afraid. Only believe, and she will be made well." That had to be extremely comforting words to frantic parents. 12-year-old daughter. When he came into the house, he permitted no one to go in except Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the girl. Now all wept and mourned for her, but he said, "Do not weep, she is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. From a human perspective, she was certifiable. She was dead, as human beings view it, but not Christ, of course. And they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. But he put them all outside, took her by the hand, and called, saying, "Little girl, arise. Little girl, arise." And then we see the action of a resurrection here in type of a human being, as spelled out in the Old Testament, in Ecclesiastes and elsewhere, when it said, verse 55, simply, "Then her spirit returned." Her spirit returned. From where? Well, from God. So it had already been in safekeeping with the Father in heaven, and at Christ's behest, he sent it back. That's how it works. 1 Corinthians 15 and many other scriptures confirm that. "And she arose immediately, and he commanded that she be given something to eat, and her parents were astonished," to say the least, "but he charged them to tell no one what had happened." So they went from natural parental fear of losing a child to awe, reverential, reverential. Now, as we know, the world has and we'll have many reasons to fear in the coming days. God makes this very clear in his word. The humbling of man will be a rather painful process. But we also know a time is coming when this will all be changed. And that time is signified in the weekly Sabbath, as well as the soon coming Feast of Tabernacles, as we well know. And again, it is expressed beautifully in Micah chapter 4, verse 4. And I'm going to read several other scriptures here that underscore this is what's coming, and then we'll get into our part in that, of course. But in Micah 4:4, like I said, this is richly symbolic of the millennial rule of Jesus Christ and what will take place. In Micah 4:4, "But everyone," again, "everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid." Can you imagine a world like that right now? Where children don't have to worry about walking home from school alone, or parents for that matter, or women walking alone at night in a city, or even guns, where the prospect in Chicago of being shot is pretty high these days if you're out at a certain hour in a certain neighborhood. I don't have to tell you all that, but I think all of us living in a big city, you do, underscore, because you've been there. You've been in a parking lot perhaps late at night and the light's not on, and you don't know if the camera's working. Huh? Been there? I've been there. You're looking over your shoulder, hustling to your car, because you just don't know what's in the night. And of course, that's what we know the adversary works the hardest, at night. But anymore, it's in the daytime, as we heard just recently in Minneapolis. In Jeremiah chapter 30, I'm going to go through few scriptures here talking about this glorious time ahead. Jeremiah chapter 30 in verse 10. This is what our peoples have to look forward to after they go through a rather tough stint. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 10. Therefore, do not fear, O my servant Jacob. That's right. Don't be given to the first kind of phobos, terror, craven fear, carnal fear. Do not fear, God says, nor be dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save you from afar and your seed from the land of captivity. Jacob shall return and have rest and be quiet, and no one shall make him afraid. And no one shall make him afraid. Ezekiel chapter 34. Ezekiel 34, 28. These are comforting scriptures to us because we know what is coming and how we will play a part in making sure this is fulfilled. Ezekiel 34, verse 28, and they shall no longer be a prey for the nations. That's right, our people are going to become a prey, and perhaps much sooner than we realize. Nor shall beasts of the land devour them, but they shall dwell safely, and no one shall make them afraid. And I'll raise up for them a garden of renown. I appreciated Mr. Laustad's sermonette, and this talks about that. I will raise up for them a garden of renown, and they shall no longer be consumed with hunger in the land, nor bear the shame of the Gentiles anymore. A tremendous prophecy there. Ezekiel 39, just a couple more, verses 25 through 29. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, and now I will bring back the captives of Jacob, and have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name. After they have borne their shame and all their unfaithfulness in which they were unfaithful to me, when they dwelt safely in their own land and no one made them afraid, when I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them out of their enemies' lands, and I am hallowed in them in the sight of many nations. So they're going to go through, as Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, a time when fear will reign, and not the good kind of fear. As it says, they'll be afraid to go to sleep. They'll be afraid to wake up in the morning. They'll be afraid at the sound of a leaf. It's going to be a traumatic time. But we look past that and we know it's coming. Then they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who sent them into captivity among the nations, but also brought them back to their land and left none of them captive any longer. And I will not hide my face from them anymore, for I shall have poured out my spirit on the house, whole house of Israel, says the Lord God. And then Zephaniah chapter 3. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 13. Before Haggai, after Habakkuk, if that helps. Zephaniah 3:13. The remnant of Israel shall do no unrighteousness and speak no lies, nor shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed their flocks and lie down, and no one shall make them afraid. So those are just four of many, many prophecies we know, many of which we'll hear during the Feast of Tabernacles in just a few short weeks. It is an absolute ironclad promise. So the entire nation we know of Israel, all 10 tribes, 12 tribes, 13, will be brought back from captivity, and no one shall make them afraid. They will reverence the Lord their God the way God always intended it. An absolute ironclad promise. So that brings us to you and me. In the movie Kingdom of Heaven, I don't know how many have seen that movie, starring Orlando Bloom, Liam Neeson, and Eva Green. Godfrey of Evelyn, played by Liam Neeson, gave final instructions before he died to his son Balian, played by Orlando Bloom. The setting, of course, was in the Middle East, 1100s, I believe, during the Crusades. So Godfrey was passing on some sage advice to his son about his responsibilities as a knight. Those who have seen the movie perhaps reflect on this. He said to Balian, Orlando Bloom, speak the truth, even if it leads to your death. Be fearless in the face of your enemies, that God may love thee. Serve the king and protect the people. Good advice for any soldier, even Christian soldiers. You know, David was a man after God's own heart. not because he had no fears. I think you read through the Psalms, it makes it very clear. But because he, despite those fears, he trusted God and moved forward into battle. It's comforting to know that our elder brother has gone through this process. The author and finisher of our faith, the captain of our salvation, chief apostle of our soul, our ever-interceding high priest, understands what you and I are going through. In Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, he was the pioneer. After all, he is the first of the first fruits. He led the way. He knows exactly what it's like to be in the flesh and understand fear. He never let it get the best of him, of course, but understanding that he knew the prophecies concerning what would happen to him, what he would have to go through. He lived 30-some years in Roman occupation. He saw crucifixions. He saw mistreatment. He understood what it was going to be like. Notice in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, about our elder brother, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplication with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear. So he, like David, a man after God's own heart, he knew what his fear was all about. He just never gave in to it, never let it get the best of him. But it kept him drawing closer and stay closer to his Heavenly Father. And it was heard because of his godly fear. I'm going to make another confession to you, because confession is good for the soul. One of my great fears has been and continues to be public speaking. I know I'm not alone in this. Thanks to God, it has gone from a phobia to merely an apprehension. So I've made some progress over the last 40 years or so. And I can distinctly remember my senior year at Ambassador College. I was student body president and a ministerial trainee that year. This is going back a lot of years. My first sermonette was in front of the Big Sandy congregation in the auditorium in Big Sandy. And yes, I was shaking like the proverbial leaf. I had prepared, of course, and asked God to calm me down. But I can go back and picture myself where I was sitting in the auditorium at that particular time. And I was nervous, to say the least. I was nervous right up until my foot hit the first step leading to the stage. And I can still remember the calm that settled over me. And believe me, I was grateful then. And I'm still grateful to this day that God showed mercy. Later that spring, I also had to give a graduation commencement address to an audience that included the likes of Ted Armstrong and Ron Dart and a whole host of other seasoned speakers. I survived that one too, and God continues to grant me favor in this area. And so I guess the only reason I bring it up is courage is not the absence of fear, but the unwillingness to give in to fear. And I think a few quotes will suffice here. Mark Twain said, "Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear." Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. This is a good one from John Wayne. "Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway." Okay? From a gentleman by the name of Eddie Rickenbacker, I don't know how many remember that name, very famous in history of this country, World War I fighting ace. I actually met him at a book signing many years ago in Dayton. He was advanced in years, but still had a presence. You could see that there was a fearlessness about him, and I actually have a signed copy of his autobiography. But he says this, "Courage is doing what you're afraid to do. There can be no courage unless you're scared." Makes some sense. And then one more. from a lady I think all of us are aware of, her history, Anne Frank. He who has courage and faith will never perish in misery. He who has courage and faith will never perish in misery. 1 John chapter 4, final scripture here before we wrap it up. 1 John chapter 4, verses 17 and 18. John is inspired to write, "Love has been perfected, or more properly, is being perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so are we in this world." That's right. Christ went through everything you and I are going through. He understands, and he and the Father are extremely, extremely sympathetic to our fears. But they never take their eye off of their expectations for us, which is to become fearless. In verse 18, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear." So yes, God is still working with us in this area. It is a process. We all advance at different paces. Still, perfection is what we're being prepared for, and that includes this area of removing fear. Brethren, as we all are very well aware of, fear is a powerful emotion. It can drive us away from our God or to our God. As we also know, God did not call us to remain fearful in the human sense, the natural sense. To the contrary, we've been called to become bold as lions, fearless, if you'll allow, Sarah-like. Our Father, through Christ, has given us the tools to become so. It's all a part of the process, the training, the being perfected in love. We all look forward to the time when we no longer fear anything, pain, loss, intimidation, rejection, you name it, or the 600-some phobias that are listed in their entirety. We're here in part to conquer our own fears so that we'll be better able to serve those who have them and help fulfill one of the mandates of the millennial rule of Christ as recorded in Micah 4:4, "And no one shall make them afraid." Again, no one said it would be easy. We know it's not. What we need to believe is that it is possible. Our Father and Elder Brother make it so. And they provided numerous examples around us to remind us of this fact, this reality.